This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network on your local community radio stations. Allegro Non Troppo would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation, the Community Broadcasting Association, and APRA for sponsoring and running our show. On today's show, we're going to be talking to Dr. Ruth McNair, and the topic of our show today is parenting options and why bother for homosexuals. Dr. Ruth McNair is one of my personal heroes and somebody I look to with the highest respect and admiration. As well as being a highly qualified doctor and a lecturer at Melbourne University, she has researched and championed many amazing developments in the awareness of lesbian health.
Dr. McNair has also participated in the change in legal and social attitudes to IVF and also has been remarkably modest about the whole thing. It's an enormous thing, a welcome to her today and to acknowledge the work she's done in the community, the medical industry and in particular for the lesbian community. We welcome her with the warmest regards to Allegro today. We'll look at the issues of homosexual parenting in depth.
Ruth McNair, welcome to Allegro Non Troppo and the Community Radio Network. This is your first time on the network.
Yeah, it is. So thanks for having me and thanks for that lovely introduction.
All sincere and honest, let me tell you. Ruth, the first thing we're going to have a look at the moment that I want to discuss with you is why, what's happened in the last 20 years? You know, in the 70s and the 80s, gay people with children just didn't exist, and now it seems to be an epidemic.
Mm. Well, why? I think they did exist in the 70s and 80s, but they were isolated and individual. So there was no real network unless people had one or two friends. So they weren't overt in any way in our gay and lesbian community, let alone the mainstream community. But now I think it has grown exponentially over the last decade or two, partly because as people see it, it's more obvious and younger gay and lesbian people are saying, well, it is an option for me now. You know, in the past, 20, 30 years ago, most people coming out would say, well, that's one of the things I lose. If I come out as a gay person or a lesbian person, I lose the option to parenthood. Whereas now people are saying, well, I don't lose it. It's still an option for me. And in fact, it's a growing option.
You think that's really what's happened? It's because I can't really fathom why gay and lesbian people want to try and mimic heterosexuals and have the same sort of families. Is that, am I being overly cynical, do you think?
Yeah, I think you are. I think actually this is a human need. It's an innate human need. So it just proves that gay and lesbian people are human and have a reproductive urge.
Do you think that this need is equal between men and women, or do you think women are more nurturing and they have a greater need?
Gee, that's an interesting question. Look, I think men can be just as nurturing and have just as much need. It's just there's a social construction around it which says to all men in our society, well, you don't need to be as responsible as women do. And that's existed for decades, maybe centuries now. And some men in our community, heterosexual or gay, have said, no, I don't believe that. I believe that I have an equal responsibility to parents. So, you know, more and more men are coming out in that way as well, whatever their sexuality is.
Is it a process perhaps of self-validation? Are they having children because they want to be seen that they can have children and that they can do it? Is it the fact that now gay and lesbian people can have children, that they're doing it just because they can rather than there's some great internalised need?
I think it's much more than that. That's part of it, perhaps. They're saying, well, we can, so we're going to try. And we're going to prove ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as soon as they look at the figures and realise how much it's going to cost them, not only for the IVF, but also for the ongoing expenses, they probably wouldn't do it for that reason.
Well, I mean, I think of it in this way that, you know, once I did the Great Victorian Bike Ride, and it's because I could. I had something to prove to myself. But that was a one-off event, 10 days, finished. I mean, everyone realises when they're entering into parenting, this is not a one-off event. This is a lifelong experience. You never finish being a parent. You never finish having the responsibility. So I think everyone would go into it with that in mind, not just the personal challenge or something to prove.
There are some people who argue that a child needs a mother and a father. How would you answer that argument?
Well, yes, this is perhaps the argument from the Conservatives. It's existed for a long time. They really haven't shifted. And I've done a lot of reading on this because I wanted to be sure that I wasn't just coming from a perspective of, oh, that's rubbish, without thinking about it and without really researching it. And, you know, if you look at children's outcomes in different types of parent families, there is no difference. In fact, I shouldn't say that, but let's start with there is no major difference amongst children's development and socialisation and so on if they're in a two-parent family, regardless of sex of the parents, or even one-parent family in single-by-choice families. So, you know, it's pretty clear from research over the last 20 years that that's the case. In fact, now we're starting to see some differences. So having said, okay, there's no major basic difference. Children who are raised by either two women or two men or a single woman or man actually have some differences in terms of awareness of diversity and understanding of marginalisation and ability to
You're really
connect.
Selling this issue, aren't you?
Yep, I am.
It's interesting what you say about perceptions, because my partner has a daughter and she's 15 now. Uh-huh. And her attitude towards same-sex couples is just fantastic. Mm. I mean, she's grown up with it all her life, so it's not an issue for her at all.
Exactly. And that's part of the deal. I think the children in our families see it as a natural family. Until they come across the social attitudes that are very negative, you know, that children need a mother and a father. And I'm sure that most of our children go through a phase of thinking, well, is that the case? Have my parents been duping me into believing this myth? But they come out the other end and they say, well, no, this is true. It is a natural family. Everyone out there who are saying the opposite have something.
Can I just throw in a spanner in the works? I teach primary school 4 days a week. I teach a lot of prep 1, 2, 3, and 4 kids.
Yep.
And the kids that come from homes, broken homes, where they don't have a father, got no idea how much they gravitate towards me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get bear hugs around the legs at playtime and lunchtime from all these kids who don't have fathers at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I had never thought until the last few years since I've seen this happening to me that it made any difference not having a father there, but I don't know. I'm starting to change my mind. I'm heading towards the conservative from my experiences to think that perhaps the male figure really isn't important and as much as the female figure would be.
Yes. I think we have to look at what's happening to those children.
Mm.
So these are children from broken homes, as you said. So there's an element of disturbance of something's not right here, of I had a dad and now he's not around, or it's harder to see him. So there's a sense of loss in those families.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very rational.
You know, whereas in a family that's, you know, either single by choice, there are some parents around who are in that category now, or gay or lesbian families, you know, this is the status quo for them. They've grown up this way. There's no disruption, hopefully. Things are as they've always been. So, you know, the literature is very different when you look at disrupted or broken families versus same-sex families.
Let's have a little look at some of the issues about actually the acquisition of children for gay and lesbian people, because that's, and we'll come back to some of these other issues a little later. There's four areas, I think, where people can get children or try to get children. The first obvious one is where people come together and there's an arrangement, either through IVF or surrogacy or something, and they have an arrangement. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I have a few friends they've gone through the process of creating a family where it's been two lesbians and two gay men, or one gay man and two lesbians, or whatever. But they've come together and then they've had children, and they've had an arrangement. And some of them have been in just fairly loose arrangements, and some of them have been really strict. But quite a number of them have turned fairly sour. So,
okay, yes.
Dr. Ruth McNair, from your experience, if two people, gay men and lesbians, are going to come together, can you give them some advice what they should do?
Yes, and I see a lot of couples, lesbian couples and their donors, in this phase of negotiation before they've actually conceived. But when they're still trying to work out if this is the right match for them. And I can see that the people for whom it works best are those that have an excellent communication between all the parties involved, who think ahead, who think about all the possible scenarios in their life, you know, if they're going to move away, if they might separate, if the donor gets a new partner, if one of the mothers gets a new partner. So, you know, all of the possibilities, even though we don't like thinking about these potentials in our life, and plan for what might happen. And also think of all of the good possibilities, even where a child might go to school or what the child might be called. You know, if let's say the lesbian couple and the gay couple, if that's the grouping, have sat down for, and I think it takes many hours and many months to discuss this, thought through all the scenarios, got some legal advice as well, because a lawyer would be very good at raising the difficult issues and how they might deal with it, set it down on paper, and then revisited it at regular intervals as the child was growing up. So maintaining that communication and respectful adjustment.
How binding would some agreement like that made through a lawyer actually really be?
It's not legally binding at all.
Okay.
But the court system and the lawyers are saying to us, even now in this current new climate with the law changing, it's still useful to have a parenting agreement between all of the parties, which, because it sets out the intentions at the beginning, it also means that the people have to discuss issues and make decisions early on. So when, if or when the situation changes, at least the law can say, well, this is what you all agreed to at the beginning. There's no dispute about it.
It's a very tricky issue, and it's one that people really need to consider, because, as I was saying, I have seen some situations, quite a few, one in particular that happened only just recently, where the there was two women, two guys, and the two women separated, and the one who had the children then went overseas.
Yep. Yeah, and that's a very difficult situation. I mean, having said that, the main reason that there's dispute that I have seen is a difference in opinion about contact. And it might go either way. It might be the women saying, look, we don't want you, the donor, to have much contact. We just want you to be the sperm donor, and have periodic, occasional contact. And as the donor gets to know the child, he's saying, well, no, I want more. You know, I want to see this child more often. And so there can be a dispute. Alternatively, it can be the opposite, that the couple are thinking, well, we'd love this guy to be involved as much as he can, and then he gets a new partner and moves away and doesn't see the child at all. So, you know, there's scenarios on all aspects.
Well, you'd have to have it spelled out pretty clearly, wouldn't you, about your responsibilities and everything beforehand. I mean, there's some you can't take into account, like if you're going to become really attached to the child, but there's things like expenses, the cost of rearing the child, how much the father's going to be prepared to...
Yep, you can sort all that out early on. And I've seen... I think we hear about the disputes more than we hear about the positive outcomes. And really, I've seen so many couples who have managed this communication well, who've discussed, who've been flexible, who've seen the change in the donor and moved with him a bit. And that works so well overall.
I think you gave some really good advice when you said it really needs months of planning. And it really does. And you need to cover all contingencies. So the actual process then of creating a child, if two people decide that they want to do it and they're all in homosexual relationships, it doesn't actually have to be physical contact. They don't have to have sex. They can do it through the at-home version.
Yes.
And I have to have a little bit of a laugh myself when they say, we use the turkey baster. Now, I have used a turkey baster to baste turkeys, and let me tell you, that is not...
There's no way you could use a turkey baster. It's not very practical.
So that's a myth.
Well, perhaps it was used in the past, but
it's
now
an eyedropper, if anything. Probably
a pipette.
As long as it doesn't go back in the kitchen drawer afterwards, that's all I'm concerned about.
Yeah, I think that's fair. No, a 5ml syringe from the chemist, which you can get easily, or from user-friendly GPs out of their bottom drawer. Easy.
I heard that a lot of lesbians have boys, and the reason being is because they as soon as they become fertile, they enter the cycle and they become fertile, they inseminate at that point, and there's more likelihood that the child is going to be male if it's inseminated early in the cycle.
Yes, there is some truth to that. I used to think this was a myth, but it seems that if you inseminate just before you ovulate, which a lot of lesbians do because they're using urine testing and it's giving them a good prediction, that the male sperm have a better chance of fertilising the egg at that point. The female sperm lasts a bit longer than the male, so if you inseminate a bit late, then they're perhaps more likely to inseminate the egg. So there you go.
There's, should I say, a friend of a friend who knows a lesbian couple, and one of them particularly hates men. And she decided to, she wanted a baby, and of course the child was a boy. So, you know, we all had a bit of a chuckle about that, but you I'm wondering if there's any possibility the child could...
I think that's very unusual in this climate now, where lesbian and gay people are just so much more integrated into the general community. You know, we're not in our little enclave somewhere anymore. We're out there, we're working, we're socialising, we have male, we have female friends. So I think that scenario is very unlikely. But also, you know, I've got a two-year-old boy, and no matter how much, if I ever hated men, which I never did, but how could I possibly transfer that to my two-year-old child, who's just the absolute gorgeous, most gorgeous person in the world? So I can see the power of a small child changing that anyway, if it was there.
Dr. McNair, can I ask you a couple of personal questions about that, what you've just said?
Sure.
Why have you got a two-year-old boy?
Because,
why do you have a child?
Because I had a very strong biological urge to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, my partner didn't have the strong biological urge, but had a very strong urge to be a parent. So we agreed to go down that track.
What was it like?
Well, the actual planning process, which was many years in the making, was difficult at times because we had a lot of ambivalence. And I see people in my practice all the time who are very ambivalent because we don't... How can we understand the new lifestyle of parenting without going through it? And a lot of what you hear from parents, especially new parents, is the difficulties, the negatives, the sleep deprivation, etc. So you understand the loss of freedom that might go with it. And so for years we had this on-off, yeah, we'll do it, no, let's not.
Did you actually have role models throughout that process? Because where do gay and lesbians turn for role models in this instance?
Well, I think actually we turn to our parents still. Yep. Why not? You know, they're the people we understand, or the family structure we understand the best because we've grown up in it. But, yeah, I had lesbian parenting role models, definitely.
Yep.
Who were saying to me, look, you know, just go with it. You can't work it out until you've done it. And so we did in the end.
Yeah, there's also the concern that, I mean, it can happen in any family, but you can start off with the best of intentions, but then, as has happened on a number of occasions, you split up. Now, I wonder how many people are prepared for that scenario.
Very few, because human nature dictates that we don't want to think about negatives in our future. I think most lesbian couples I've seen are planning this child together forever, not expecting to separate. So that's, I don't think people factor that into their planning. And why should they? You know, let's keep it positive.
We're talking to Dr. Ruth McNair here on Allegro Non Troppo across Australia and the Community Radio Network. We're looking at the issues of gay parenting. We're going to talk a little bit after this music track about some of the options for gay parents. We've talked about two homosexual couples, lesbians and gay men, coming together to create children. And we're going to look at some of the other options that exist and then look at some of the ethical issues that are contained in all of these things. This is Allegro Non Troppo. On Allegro Non Troppo today, we're talking to Dr. Ruth McNair, who is an academic and a general practitioner, and she's also been, I suppose, am I being a bit over the top saying that you're the champion for lesbian health issues? You're one of the champions.
One of them, yes. Yeah. There are a few in Australia, but not many.
But also looking at the role of reproduction as well.
That's part of the lesbian health issues.
Do you like it?
Oh, I love it, yeah. Because, well, general practice is very isolating. You just sit in your room all day and see people individually. So to understand people from a community, from the community perspective, is so much more enriching, I think.
Yes, I imagine it would be.
Yeah.
We've been talking about options for gay parenting and how couples come together and they produce children, homosexual couples. You wanted to mention and talk about what happens when people want to have a child, but they want an anonymous situation. Mm. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, so quite a few lesbian couples and single women are really concerned about these issues that we've been discussing about dispute with donors. And so for them, or one of the reasons for going down the anonymous donor track is avoiding all concerns, all difficulties with a donor.
Okay.
And, you know, whether or not they may have ever had a difficulty, that's the reason that shifts them into the anonymous donor.
Is there an ethical imperative in this? Is it, what would it be?
Well, I'm really an advocate for the rights of the child as well. So right. I'm thinking, yes, it's fine to go down the anonymous donor path, but the child still needs to know who that person is at some point in their life.
Can you validate that statement?
Yeah. There have been studies looking at identity for donor-conceived children, and these have come partly from heterosexual families where one of the parents is infertile and that they've had to use a donor for that reason. And increasingly we're seeing some studies about lesbian parented donor-conceived children as well. And there's quite important evidence that children in these families are very interested in who the donor is, in the person of the donor. Now, not all children. Some don't care less. But by the age of even 5 or 6, some children are asking, and not just in an ad hoc, relaxed sort of way, but they're really asking, who's my dad? What's he like? What does he look like? Why did he donate sperm to you? So, you know, these issues come up for children, and if they're not answered, or if children discover late, which is very unusual in a lesbian family, but discover late that they were donor conceived when they always assumed their father was their biological father, this has been very damaging for some children.
Can we transfer this same argument now onto surrogacy?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because now surrogacy is another step up from this. And surrogacy, for the listener who's not aware of what it is when somebody else carries the child, or they conceive and then deliver the child to the donor.
Mm.
Do you have an ethical consideration or an ethical standpoint on surrogacy, Dr. McMahon?
No, I see the same ethical issue, that it's fine, it works well, as long as the child is fully aware of who the biological parents are, as in that they exist outside of the family structure, let's say, and ideally has some potential to know the person if they want.
Could you give us an update on the issues of surrogacy as it is in Australia, please?
Mm, so a lot of what we hear about surrogacy is American, because that's what the media does. But in Australia, surrogacy is altruistic, which means that a surrogate cannot be paid large sums of money to bear a child for a couple and is only paid expenses, medical expenses. So this is a rule that's applied ever since surrogacy existed here, unlike America, where a surrogate can be paid large sums of money in the quantity of $20,000-$30,000.
There seems to be also a shift in the attitude of the community towards the rights of the child to know who their parents are. Yeah. I mean, they might be out of curiosity or for medical reasons. Mm. So what if one of the, say the donor decides that they want to remain anonymous, totally anonymous?
Mm. And, you know, 30 years ago, that was the norm, that a lesbian couple would have an intermediary who knew the donor but would never tell them who it was, deliberately. But I think it's shifted because of this growing awareness of children's perspectives and the damage that it can be causing for some children related to their identity and not knowing. So, you know, rightly so, it's shifted, and I think the safeguards can be put in place quite easily for children to become aware. So in that sense, I don't have any ethical issue at all.
Dr. McNair is an academic and a general practitioner and, as we've discovered during the show, a person of extraordinary ethical conscience. What do you think about paid surrogacy?
I think it's difficult. It can work. It can work really well. But it creates an extra dimension in terms that the parent, and usually this is a mother, so the birth mother, who's the surrogate mother, may be going through the surrogacy for reasons that are not ideal. So through poverty, through lack of understanding of her rights, so she may be being used by the system, which is very difficult. And, you know, in those situations, if the child is contacting her in the future, which is the ideal situation, to understand who that mother is, that mother may not be in a position to support or understand or accept the child as much as, say, a surrogate in Australia.
I didn't fully understand how surrogacy worked in Australia, and I believe it differs from state to state, but I think the fact that it's altruistic is probably good.
Yeah, I think it works very well in our culture.
Yeah, I think this is something that we've got right.
I agree. And sperm donors, it's the same for any tissue donation. So all sperm donors in Australia are also altruistic in the sense that they don't get paid.
I would guess that, particularly with surrogacy, if the child is born, then the birth mother may at that point decide she doesn't want to give the child away. That must cause a lot of upset.
Oh, huge. And for that reason now, surrogacy, and this happens in Australia or anywhere, it's becoming more common for the surrogate mother, so the birth mother, not to be the biological mother. So in other words, they have an egg donor. They do an IVF procedure with the sperm donor, which is often the gay man who's going to be the parent. And that embryo is implanted into a different person. And there's some proof that that means she's not as likely to want to keep the child.
Really? Knowing nothing about it, I would have thought that there would be no difference. That if you'd given birth to this child, the chances of bonding with that child immediately wouldn't be any different.
Look, and I sort of agree, having had a child now and, you know, knowing that through that whole 9 months of the pregnancy and the birth as well, you do develop a relationship with the child even though you don't know.
You can feel it inside you.
Yeah, you get quite a sense of the person, and yet there's proof that you don't necessarily need to keep the child if it's not biological.
How many cases are there that the mum actually does want to keep the child?
It's very tiny. It's something like 5% or less.
Really? Yeah. Yeah, that's quite small. I'm surprised.
I would have expected more.
Yeah, and it's partly because the selection process for the surrogate mother is very careful, no matter where it is, even if it's altruistic, hopefully. Non-altruistic. So she's selected on the basis that she's already had her own children, that she's mature in the sense of emotionally
mature. She knows what she's going to go through.
Yeah.
I logged on to one of the American websites that deals in surrogacy because I wanted to know how much.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. So I've got the shopping list.
Presumably this is US dollars.
Yes, it is. Speaking. It's US dollars, exactly. Legal expenses are between $12,500 and $15,000. Medical expenses are between $1,000 and $15,000. Advertising and account expenses for using the agency are $3,500. Psychology fees, $1,800. The miscellaneous surrogate benefits are up to $2,000, and the surrogate fee is $0 to $20,000. I was stunned by that. That's cheap.
Cheap.
I thought $20,000 for a surrogate fee was... I thought it would be a lot more than that. I certainly wouldn't carry around something like that for 9 months for 20. I would want a full 1 year salary. Level 7 executive of $120,000. I thought that would be a reasonable amount of money for a surrogate. That's not
fair.
Much at all.
Yeah, although I've talked to a few, not many, two or three women who have been surrogates, and they say to me they love being pregnant. So this is a bonus in their life. You know, it's another 9 months. Yes, apparently. Another 9 months where they can be pregnant, but they don't have to look after the child at the end. They don't get the sleep deprivation. So that's their perspective. So
I guess the more expensive it is, then it's going to put the official surrogacy into the hands of the well-to-do, isn't it?
You've just brought to my mind an issue when we did a show on abortion with Senator Lynn Allison and Leslie Kenold last year. And Lynn Allison she made history by going into the Senate and saying the reason she was supporting these bills is because she'd had an abortion. And I asked her about why she had an abortion and what did she feel about it. And she said, look, that particular time in my life, I was not in a position where I could take a few cells the size of a grain of rice and then rear it for 18 years. I just couldn't have done it. And if I had to do it, it would have been probably worked out really quite awfully. And what you've just said here about the surrogates having babies, but they don't want to actually bring the child up, it sort of makes a bit of sense. I can see that there may be something in that. I can't possibly understand what it might be, but I can understand that there are these issues that go... This has been quite interesting, recently.
Well, more concerning to me is that many gay men... For many gay men, this is one of the only options to them.
Yes,
to be a full-time parent, to obtain a surrogacy arrangement. And until very recently in Victoria, this has not been an option for them to access surrogacy in Victoria. So they've had to go interstate or overseas and pay huge amounts of money. So it hasn't been accessible to the majority of gay men, which has concerned me greatly because, you know, I see gay men in my practice and in the community who are desperate to have children.
Yes.
And fair enough. But, you know, their options are so limited, they have to compromise often on being a very part-time parent because they've had to make an arrangement with a lesbian couple who also want to be parents. So,
What kind of numbers are we talking about, the gay guys actually going through the surrogacy process in Australia?
Very few. Well, I don't know the numbers, and someone out there might know and could ring in, but a handful.
Okay.
Know, in the tens, I would say.
And how many women in Australia are willing to be altruistic surrogates, I wonder? I don't think there would be that many.
Don't know the answer to that.
No, me either. This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australian Community Radio Network on your community radio station. Our special guest is Dr. Ruth McNair. We're looking at issues of gay parenting. Dr. McNair, I wanted to talk to you about adoption and fostering. There's a huge hypocrisy being articulated in Australia, and I suspect around the world, there's a huge recruitment to get gay people to be foster parents. A few years ago, in the place where I work, they kept giving me paperwork saying, you know, you don't have any children living at home, you'd be a great foster parent. You're a great teacher, you'd be a great foster parent. And I got sucked into this. And I thought, yes, I probably would. And I filled out the paperwork and sent it in. And then after I did, I thought, my God, what am I doing? I won't be able to do all of the work that I do, and I won't be able to do the things that I do. I won't be able to go out on Saturday nights or anything anymore. Well, I don't anyway. But, you know, I'm suddenly going to be in a different situation where I don't really want to be. So I rang them up. I said, forget it. But I get letters, 3 or 4 a week, actually, from all these agencies. And I say, I'm a homosexual. And fine.
Great.
Yeah. Good. Love it. But as soon as I say, if we want to think about adoption, all the doors close. Do you know why?
Yeah, look, it's been an aberration of our legal system, I think, over the last few decades. And it's true, it's this ironic situation that's existed that gay and lesbian people have been fostering for years in Australia, or in Victoria, particularly... partly because they couldn't access local services to have children without having to pay huge amounts of money for IVF. And often the foster kids were more difficult to look after because they'd had a difficult background, their own family background. So these are not easy kids. And yet gay and lesbian people were assumed to be perfectly fine to look after them. And yet the general argument in the community against legal reform had been, well, gay and lesbian people haven't proven themselves as good parents and potentially could be damaging to children. So we have these two arguments running in parallel. And now, you know, there's a desperate need for foster parents.
You know, when you put it like that, I can actually see where the rationale comes from. Why gay and lesbians make good foster parents is because a lot of the issues in the hard times that kids have faced, we've probably faced the same things in our lives, and so therefore we can identify it.
Yeah.
And the other aspect is the reason we can't get adoption is because we haven't proved ourselves as parents. Look, that's reasonable. We have now, but up until recently, we haven't.
Well, I think that was very much formulated in a moral or religious argument from... You know, much of our legislation is still based in
Christian ethics.
So, you know, this whole argument that we raised earlier of the children need a mother and a father, they need a married couple, mother and father. You know, that's been the case until very recently in Victorian law and other Australian states.
Law can be quite there can be quite a time lag between common belief and the law. The law takes a while to catch up.
Oh, totally. I think the law is the last thing to change. And that's been the case over the last 10 years as we were arguing for legal reform in Victoria. We would see community surveys occasionally, and each survey showed an improvement in community attitudes. And also, if we just looked at the level of outrage each time the discussion in the media occurred around access to ART and adoption, you know, that the level of community outrage gradually reduced, to the extent that when the law was passed in December last year, there was very little outrage at all. There might have been one negative letter in the paper, whereas 10 years before there were scores of letters appearing and articles. And so community attitudes have changed enormously in that time, and finally the politicians have realised that it was okay.
It's a chicken and egg thing. Social attitudes change, laws change. Quite often it's the other way around. Laws change and then the social attitudes. The other thing that's happening is we're seeing a generational shift, because a lot of the people growing up now, the generation X and Y, have grown up with gay people being a part of their lives. Whereas generations ago that didn't happen. And so now we're seeing this new generation of, it's not even tolerance or acceptance, it's just it's a part of life. And that's probably coming to play in the way things go. I wanted to talk to you, Dr. McNair, and ask you some questions about sperm and egg and where you can get them. And what should you do when you've got them? Well, it's interesting because it's, from what I've read, it is quite a huge commercial concern, especially in other countries. It's not in Australia, but it is overseas. You can buy eggs on the internet, you can buy sperm on the internet, and you can find a surrogate on the internet. So we've got this internet shopping now for babies.
Yes, it can look like that. I think even in the States, I mean, I was just in the States a couple of weeks ago at a conference and went to a presentation on ART and surrogacy, and I was interested in that. I'd always assumed that it was a corrupt system in the States because of this, the payments that are happening, and you know, the potential to attract people who are really downtrodden, if you like, into the system. But I can see that once the pregnancy has occurred and the parents have achieved that child, the situation is the same as it is here. So the ethical issues, yes, are there, but in the end, these people are creating their families and living and existing in that family. So despite the difficulties or the differences in the way it starts, in the end, it's worked.
It's worked, okay. That sounds... and I'm glad that you've actually pointed that out, because that's an important thing for us to be aware of in our society, that other people do it differently, but the end product can be about the same.
That's right. And, you know, that comes back to the commodification argument that gays and lesbians are being sucked into this heterosexual model. We're just using children as a handbag or as a token.
Fashion accoutrement.
Yes, yes, you know, in the back seat of the car. And really, I don't see that.
Okay.
I don't see it at all. I see the development of families, loving families.
I want to go through another hypothetical situation, and which will lead us slightly into a different area. And that's somebody I know has several... they've had children by IVF, but they also have a number of fertilised eggs left over. And then there's this huge thing of what to do with them. Now, there's been an offer to a relative who can't have children to, would you like one of our eggs? And then there's other things. Should we just destroy them? Can we give them for stem cell research? All of this. What do you think?
That is a huge issue, and I think people who go through IVF, which is where an embryo is created outside of the body and then frozen, sometimes frozen, and can be frozen for a long period of time, part of the counselling of IVF is what would you do if you had spare embryos that you don't need as a couple, and offered those three options: destroy the embryo, give it away to someone else, some
other
couple,
or harvest it for stem cells,
or use it for research. And, you know, you throw in this decision during a process when you haven't even had a child yourself yet. Such a difficult decision. And I think, ethically, I wouldn't judge anyone going down any of those tracks. And if they were to give away the embryo to a couple or a person who couldn't have children themselves, as long as that child, the eventual child, understood all of the arrangements and why it happened and who donated.
Therein lies the difficulty.
Yeah.
Because that is a terribly complex situation. Mm. Have you had any experience with this?
I haven't had experience with understanding the child's perspective.
Right.
Because I just don't know any children who've gone through this.
Yes.
But I've had experience of talking with people about it and talking with people who've used donated embryos where neither of the couple are biologically connected. And most people are very aware of the need for the child to know because of this growing literature and the growing awareness.
Is there a legal requirement that the child needs to know?
There is in Victoria mm-hmm. and in other states around Australia that's developing, two or three other states. I think New South Wales, can't remember the other one, now have identity release legislation.
I think ART actually has been really well thought out in Australia by the sounds of it.
Mm.
What do you think?
I think it has. You know, some of the scientific advances have been well ahead of the law, but in general, the ethicists have been involved.
Mm.
The counsellors have been very well informed. So I think people who go through IVF are informed and surrogacy. And there's a lot of care in, as we were talking about, selection of surrogates. So, and it's all focused on how will the child perceive this arrangement. And, you know, you can't safeguard everything, but at least if the child is aware of, you know, some children have said to me, well, I want to know why the donor donated, for example. That's their main issue. They don't really want to know the person. They don't want to take that person on as a parent, but they just want to know why. Because some of them feel like, well, they've just given away their semen willy-nilly, didn't really care what happened. But if they can see, well, this person was counselled, they did it, they gave it away, knowing a child might eventually contact them, they were happy about that, all of that feels better for the child.
This has been a new recent development in ART, which is they've now been able to create sperm from a female eggs, which makes men redundant. Is it parthenogenesis?
Good question.
It sounds like parthenogenesis, which is the virgin birth situation, isn't it? So you can use your own eggs and create.
Yeah, I understand this is still very experimental. It's certainly nowhere near reality yet.
It'd be interesting to see what the child turned out to be like. I mean,
oh, that'd be great.
I'm sure Jermaine Greer is very happy right now.
But it's just an interesting concept to think that they can now create, or they think they can create. I mean, it's the same issue with cloning. Everybody sort of, you know, oh, we're going to have cloning, but it actually, the genetic
it's
fading.
Possible. Well, and I think our concern about that, for example, you know, is it parthenogenesis? Well, does that really matter? You know, in the end, we're caught up with that social expectation of the man-woman thing again. So if we create genetic material from two women and create a child that's healthy and genetically stable, that's okay.
That's interesting.
Because so long as that child is being raised in a loving family and understands how they were created.
You're very much into the rights of the child, aren't you?
Yeah.
And that's the focus of just about everything that you're doing.
But having said that, I'm also interested in the rights of the non-birth parent.
Yes.
Because that's been one of the most legally vulnerable areas in Australia.
Yes.
And many of the non-birth parents I speak to are most concerned about whether they'll be regarded as a parent.
So, I mean, this business about parthenogenesis, some people might argue that the only bit of fun they've had out of having a child was during the conception, and they want to take that away from us.
I think most lesbian couples wouldn't say that.
True.
Yeah.
This has been a very interesting discussion. I'd just like to wrap it up by doing a little bit of a wind-up and a recap of what we talked about today. We've looked at the issues of gay and lesbian people having children, why they do it, how they do it. We've had a look at some of the options of fostering and adoption, and we've gone through some of the ethical issues about the other areas of reproduction, looking at things like what do you do with embryos if you've created them through IVF. Dr. McNair, it's been fantastic to have you on Allegro Non Troppo once again.
Thank you
for being on the Community Radio Network, and perhaps in a few years' time we might be able to revisit this issue again when there's more development.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network on your community radio station.